Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Oh, it's going to be me. All right, everybody, welcome to another fine episode. As we start out strong for the Knife Talk podcast, we're here to keep you company, answer your questions, not ask you questions. Well, actually, we do ask you questions from time to time, and we look forward to your answers. We thank our listeners for being the best listeners on this fucking planet, and you guys really help drive this conversation. I'm here, as always, with Jeff Fader of Fader Knives and Craig Lockwood, the rock and roll star, and the Capitan of Chop Knives. We're here to just keep you busy during your commute, while you're in the shop grinding, whatever you're doing, scrubbing away on a blade. We're here to help you out, and we like to kick off with a recap. Craig, what has the last week been like for you, sir?
The last week, it's been good. It's been a really good week. But I said it's been a good week until tomorrow Friday. First off, I need new tires on the car. At the moment, the car is outside, jacked up, and I need to go first thing and change tires because we're driving back to the UK tomorrow, as soon as the kids finish school. But before that, I've got the worst possible thing that I could be doing. I'm dying, absolutely dying. So it's last week for the kids, and once a year they have like parents' days where parents come in and they teach the kids things, or they do something. So I've just shied away from picking the kid. I let my wife do it all. I'm like, I'll keep away from it because they ask me anything. And the rumors are coming back. The kids come back saying, oh, Papa, you're going to go and play guitar in school for us Friday. I'm like, no, I'm definitely not. Definitely not. Anyway, the teacher manages to find me, grabs hold of me, and says, look, on Friday, we've arranged, you're going to come in and play some songs for the kids. And I'm like, oh, no. So I'm just like, oh, Jesus. I can't say no, but I'm just like, I'm dying, dreading it. So the next day, she catches me again and says, there's another father who plays guitar, and he's going to play with you, and you're going to play Disney songs, and the kids will love it. And I'm just like, oh, fuck. So she said, I'm going to give him your number, and he can ring you. And I'm just like, fuck. So my phone was off now for the next 2 days. There's no way this guy can get hold of me. So I'm at the school yesterday, and there's only one other British father there. It's a small school anyway, and majority of people there don't speak English, you know. So he's like, oh, he's winding me up, saying, I'm looking forward to Friday. It's going to be good. I'm looking forward to your gig. And I'm like, whoa, it's not a gig to begin with. And also, I think I've got away with it because I've had my phone off and this guy hasn't been able to ring me. As I say that, a teacher walks out of the class. She gets very excited to see me. And the guy standing next to me, who was that guy who's been trying to ring me, also speaks perfect English. And I'm like, oh, so the ground swallows me up. Oh, and then he's like, okay, so Friday morning, we rehearse 9:45. We're back at the school in front of the teacher. This other dad who speaks English, he's just pissing himself laughing, just like, we got you. So tomorrow, I've got to go into the school, play fucking Disney songs with some random French dude. Like, it's like a school assembly in front of everybody. I don't know what songs, I don't know what we're going to be doing. It's going to be winging it on the spot. And I'm just like, oh my God.
Oh God.
And then I got an 18-hour drive out straight from that as well. So it's, ugh.
What can we pay for you to play? Don't piss on my party.
Can you imagine?
Jeez. Hola. Bonjour, kids. Here we go. We're going to play a little piss on the party. 355s, bitch.
So to sum things up, it's been a great, great week. Great, great week. Tomorrow, it's going to be the shittiest day ever.
So have you thought about what you're going to play?
Well, this other dad's got it all mapped out. Apparently, he's got Disney songs. And
oh, so all you have to do is hit a couple chords, and you're gonna just mail it in, right?
Yeah, just accompany him and work it out on the spot. Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
God, please, please, someone take video. Is there any way of that for us? Just for us? We won't post it.
No, I don't think so.
Wear a Mickey Mouse shirt?
I should do, shouldn't I, really?
You should have a Mickey Mouse shirt on.
I've got one. I should do. You're right. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God. And then this is the best part. The best part is, I remember you posted on your Instagram stories, well, which sneakers should I wear for the big event? And you had these three pairs of fucking kick-ass sneakers. I'm hoping you're going to do the same thing. You should treat this the same way as that all one.
That's a real gig.
Give the fucking teacher your rider. You know, create a beer. Moe or no play, baby. You know
what they say? Moe, no showe.
Moe, no showe.
No shandon, no bandon.
Yeah, you should totally give them like a rider. This is my rider.
Yeah. No, the kids are looking forward to it anyway. And
because they know you're a rock star and they're going to
be able
to
show
their friends.
My wife can't stop giggling every time she looks at me because she knows I've been landed straight in it. Oh man, but yeah. So yeah, do that, then an 18-hour drive. So,
God, the driving you do, it's insanity.
I don't mind the driving so much, to be honest with you. It's not too bad. It's just normally normally I get to sleep at the day before to sort of bank up some sleep. But no, I'm playing to a bunch of fucking shitty pan kids. Anyway, I'm not bitter about it. Mareko, how are you?
I'm doing good. I actually did a bit of driving, but not fucking 18 hours. I only did about 5 hours each way. But I went down to my friend's wedding last weekend. That was good.
Nice.
Saw some people I hadn't seen in a fucking since I graduated high school, really. So it's been about 22 years now since I saw them last. But it was good to catch up. I had a friend down there that I stayed with as well, who I've been friends with since high school. And I don't see him as much since he moved down. So did a bit of catch up with and socializing and too much drinking, mixing of booze. And he had these like 130 or 120 proof fucking bourbons and whiskeys that are out of the barrel and not fucking diluted or anything. It was too much. And he's a beer collector. So we were drinking all these fucking heady, tasty beers, but super, felt like dog shit most days. Wow. That's not my life anymore. And so, but other than that, get ready to go down as we record tomorrow. I take the kid down, back down to Oregon, to Eugene, Oregon. I'm going to be seeing, Don Wynn down there and Jeremy Spake, Ben Tendick, a bunch of people, Ian Rogers, a bunch of people I hadn't seen in a long time. Bill Burke. Bunch of fucking people. It's cool. I'm excited. The Oregon Knife Collectors show. By the time people hear this, it's going to be too late to come to the show. But try to plan for it in the future because it's kind of a small show, but there's a lot of really cool people there, and it's very laid back, and it's and there's a lot of good work there. So you get a good amount of socializing time as well as getting to see some quality work there. There are makers there like Ed Shemp, who's kind of a legend in Damascus world, who I'm excited to see. And see what kind of work he has. So that's coming up. I also, we just posted, so me and Charlie Ellis, who else? Will Stelter, Salem Straub, and Joshua Prince are going to be part of a discussion panel on Damascus pattern development at Blade University. And we just posted that yesterday. It's going to be June 8th. I can't remember what day that is exactly. It might be Saturday. I think it's Saturday. And it's going to be at 4:00. So if people are interested, it's going to be part of the Blade University. Going to be a discussion panel on this kind of top secret steel that we made last April, actually, about a year ago now. And we're all going to have pieces there that we've made from this particular steel that uses kind of pattern assembly that people haven't really done before, and it has a lot to do with like hexagons and stuff like that. So it'll be interesting and exciting to see how that all plays out.
Blade University is part of Blade Show.
Yeah, Blade University is part of Blade Show. It's really cheap. It's like $25. There's going to be a ton of really great presentations. And so if you got the time and to step away from walking around the show, go see some of those presentations, because $25 is a pretty low price to pay for some of the big time value you're going to get from some of these conversations and discussion panels and presentations. So other than that, I'm getting ready for the, Eugene. And then I'm going down to Sacramento. I'm working on this fucking Loveless knife still, but it's coming together. It's a lot of, because I'm doing a museum fit up. There's a lot of, and it's all hidden pins, except for the lanyard pin. So it's put it together, take it apart, put it together, take it apart, put it together. And it's a lot of this back and forth, but I finally got to the place where the handle is sculpted. It's got kind of like that chamfered edge where it transitions to the full tang and the guard. The tang guard blade are all hand sanded out. So the next steps tomorrow are to mark the blade, get it etched, and really make that steel that I made with Will Brigham down in Huntington Beach, California, a couple of years ago, to make that steel, mosaic Damascus steel, pop. And then it's off to Francesca Ricci, who is going to make a beautiful sheath for it.
But that sounds good.
Yeah, staying busy.
You're busy.
Too busy.
Too busy. Never busy enough. Far as I'm
You've done a lot of traveling, haven't you, the last month or so?
Oh, I got more, too. I got a lot coming up. But, yeah. Nice. Jeff, what's happening, bud?
All sorts of stuff. We just finished, we kind of got approval for the third collaboration we're going to be doing. We're finishing up a set with the chef Elon Hall from Food Network. We're finishing up next week. That will be done. We got approval from another chef in Philly. The prototype's finished and he loves it. That's number two. And then I just finished, we're doing a bread knife exclusively for this bakery in our town next door. Well, a young guy by the name of Chase and his wife opened up this place called the Hudson Oven, and I've been friendly with them for a while. And they do this kind of neat scavenger. They started out doing scavenger hunts where they would leave a dresser somewhere, and they'd fill it with bread, and then they'd do a scavenger hunt, and you could find the bread, and then you'd leave what you want, and they opened up a bakery. So I just got back from them, and we kind of finished the prototype, the design for the bread knife that it's going to be only sold there. So exciting. And then we're finishing up, like I said, three things. We have two more. We're chasing down two more collaborations we're going to be working with, which is a lot of fun. And it's just like, I've said this before, and I guess when we first started, that I don't see this as like this artisanal knife shop. I see this like a metal shop. So I'm constantly, after spending years with this other metal shop and the appraiser and the boss and stuff like that, I'm really trying to run jobs through this shop. So I'm excited that I've been able to kind of put together, and we're orchestrating it all, and we're going to be working on three or four different collaborations at the same time. And it's been a really good way to figure out new ways to organize myself. Everything's been good. But I just got back from, 5 hours. You say 18 hours. I went 5 hours each way to Johnstown, Pennsylvania. I was teaching at the Center for Metal Arts. And we had another really, really special weekend workshop. I teach an introductory class. I only want to do introductory classes. My job is to get people into CMA, and Center for Metal Arts is it's just every time I go down, I teach twice a year. Every time I go down, Pat has done something new, and it's just exciting. And he and I have been spending a lot of time together. We've been doing a series on Full Blast where once a month he comes on, and it's called Great Question with Pat Quinn. And you can ask blacksmithing questions, real world forging questions from a guy who has over 20 years of forging education. So it's really blacksmith-oriented, forging-oriented, anvils, tools, discipline, and stuff like that. But we've really been focusing heavy on the educational end of forging. And I found out I was talking to my old lead man, John Ledford. He came to the shop yesterday, and we were talking. And it dawned on – he kind of told me that – I didn't even realize this. I've been involved with forging education in the CMA for 19 years. I started at CMA 19 years ago as a fabricator and taking classes and learning. And it didn't. I'm very fortunate enough that I was in a position where I was hired to be a fabricator. And then the boss had made the decision to pay me and put me through all the classes that were going through there. And he was a super cheap guy. He was a super duper cheap guy. And I kind of wondered why he was so willing to pay me and put me through the classes. And he said one day, very frankly, it's cheaper for me to have you learn correctly than for you to fumfer around in the shop. Because I'll make more money if you know what the fuck you're doing.
Feel more efficient, yeah.
Than if you're just fumfering around and trying to learn on the job. And it's something that I've been really, I feel very strongly about in terms of the concept of people taking classes and education, forging education, and taking it seriously. Because what's happening now is, and I'm talking to a lot of people, I was in touch with the people of New England School of Metalwork. They asked me to do a class and or something, and I don't think I'm going to do it, only just because I really feel strongly about focusing on the Center for Metal Arts. I know that all these schools are feeling there's a certain degree of saturation point where there are people opening up their garages and they're opening up schools left and right. And and what's happening is there's a thirst that's being quenched by people who, you know, I'm saying this as respectfully as possible, you know, have a very limited understanding of forging education, not forging, but forging education.
Right.
And I'm really trying to do everything I can to help Pat kind of really focus on what are we doing as, you know, how is forging education going to progress? You guys have any opinions on just forging education or metalworking education or knife making education?
I mean, I agree. I think it's important to go to somebody who really has a depth of experience and knowledge and wisdom that comes from successes, but also failures. And I think there's a lot of value in learning from somebody with that depth of experience. But I can also understand how, you know, maybe there's somebody who like can't afford to travel long distance or
of course,
or and they got somebody local and they got a little bit of experience. And so they do a little bit from that person. But yeah, from reputable, taking classes from reputable sources and reputable schools who are offering classes from the people that you follow as a student, like the general you who, or even I follow, honestly, that's the place where I really want to go. I would love to go to Johnstown and take some classes. I've done classes at the New England School of Metalwork, but I think it is really important that people are getting their education from somebody who has a depth of experience.
Well, here's a couple things. One is the fact that forging in and of itself has been recreational for, and Pat and I have been talking about this for a while, for under 50 years, 50 to 70 years, forging as a recreation. You know, I made a joke saying, Jesus, when they put Jesus up on the cross, they didn't use zip ties. You know how old forging actually is. You know how old forging is. But as a recreation, it's very new. So there isn't a huge depth of people who have spent time as educators and what is forging education, but it's not just a good blacksmith. A good blacksmith might not be a good teacher. And that's unfortunate. That's just the way it is. And because there's not this depth of experience there, it's hard for people or instructors to learn how to become good educators. And hopefully these garage shops are sparking the interest of someone, and those people will try to, you know, further their education at a place where they're, you know, people are really spending time. Now, Pat and I talk about, you know, when he interviewed, he knew me for years before I applied, and then he interviewed me about my teaching style. And luckily for me, I actually have experience. I've spent time with as a instructor. I've spent time as an assistant, and there's a lot of things you need to know if you're going to teach a class or run a class. Part of it is not only safety of the class, you have to be able to express yourself well. You have to be able to get somebody over the finish line, and you have to be organized in terms of your time frame. You have to know where the class needs to be at certain points. Now, on a knife making class, you have to know that you have to have the forging done by a certain time because you have to have the knives heat treated and tempered before the next step. So there's a lot to it, and I just really I'm gonna leave you alone. You want to talk about education? Fine by me. I feel like it's really important for people to really focus on if they want to improve themselves. They're going to a reputable place. Now, last thing I will say, and I'll definitely leave you alone, is Pat offers scholarships because the CMA is nonprofit. They're able to have grants and they're able to have scholarships to offset the cost because he understands. If in his mind, he's hoping to get to the point where, you know, it would be great and he wants to have the education be, you know, subsidized. And then he wants to focus on the education, and the education isn't about, the school isn't about money. As a teacher, if there's three students or eight students, I get paid the same. You don't give a fuck. He's not going to be, I've been at places where they'll pay you as an instructor based on how many students there are. This is not a make money place. This is like, he's really wanted this to be a forefront of education. All right, I'll leave you. I've said enough. I'll leave you alone. But I mean, if you have any opinions on it or...
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Clearly, but I mean, when I think back to, you know, sort of formal education sort of schools, when you mentioned that, you know, skill sets that you need to be an educator, it's like, the teachers that I liked and got along with, I was generally better at those subjects.
Right.
If that makes sense, you know? So I think a lot of it is social skills as well.
Sure.
You know? You don't want to go in, you know, certain teachers, they may have been the most knowledgeable, the greatest at what they do.
But they suck as teachers.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, yeah. And you just couldn't. You couldn't learn from them because you didn't like them, you know. So I suppose that's one skill that a good educator needs as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. My in high school, my sophomore year in high school, when I was 13, 14 years old, I had a history teacher, and up to that point, all the TV shows and all the conversations I've heard about high school, it was like history is the most boring shit ever, and I had a history teacher who was fucking phenomenal. I only had him for 1 year, but the way he taught was that he had such a strong passion for it, is that he was, instead of just reading out of a book and it being fucking droll and lame, he was telling stories and interacting with the audience, I guess the students, and really like engaging them in a meaningful way. And it really, for me personally, I loved it. And I was not a good student, but I got an A in that class. And
he connected with you.
Yeah. And I think the teacher definitely did a good job conveying the information in a meaningful way so that it stuck. And I still remember a lot of that history that I learned because it was just, and to me, it was just an interesting story. And even now,
when you're talking about, you know, various makes that you're doing, you always have a historical element to them as well, don't you? It's a passion that you've still got.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I do think I had a little bit of like a bent for history and people's stories and past and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, I could see how history can be extremely boring if it's just read this book, read that book, take the test, but this teacher was also an artist, and so he would draw across the whiteboard these elaborate scenescapes. Like, you see all these videos where people are doing the illustrations and stuff as they're going through the dialogue, and you see these drawings on these YouTube videos. He would draw like that, but he would be telling the story of history for that particular lesson that day. And that's what it was like for me.
Well, that shows you a degree of, you know, the professionalism of understanding how to connect with someone. And I just what I'm getting at really is I know that I've recently been seeing a lot more people selling their tools. There are a lot more grinders and anvils and power hammers and stuff for sale. And I feel as though that a lot of times, and we've covered this before a few times, is that people are covering their technique by buying equipment. And I think that investing in your future, part of that is investing in your understanding of what you're doing.
Sure.
And I cannot help, and I can't say it enough, that instead of, you know, I'll leave you alone. I'll leave you alone. I've said what I've said. And I just feel very strongly. I don't want to be like Nick. Nick Rossi is unbelievable. Nick Rossi is one of probably the best teachers around. He loves it, and he travels everywhere. I can't do that. I don't want to do it. And it's sure. Like I do the teaching at the Center for Mental Arts, and that's it, just because I believe in them.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know why I went so crazy, but I did.
Yeah, I mean, I think I enjoy sharing my process, but I don't know if I'm necessarily a great teacher, but I have been learning through getting reps and
that's
feedback
it.
That there are definitely things that I need to have in place especially regards to preparedness. Like, I have all the information in my head, but having it organized in a meaningful way so that when I present it, it follows a kind of a logical order of operations, so that when we get to the end of the whatever day of the last class or the last day, everybody's with me and everybody's on the same page, and they're all like, seeing it all click with everybody is fucking awesome. But the last couple of years, as I'm starting to do more teaching, I am definitely also learning at the same time, and I'm making adjustments as I go. So I think preparedness, I guess, it's something a good teacher has.
Yeah. All right. Well, I just, you know.
Hopefully be a great teacher like your history teacher and not a pedophile like my history teacher.
Oh my God. You know, maybe you're...
We're pretty sure he was. We really are.
My fourth grade teacher, well, one of the fourth grade teachers in my school was definitely a pedophile.
Yikes. Yeah.
So don't be a pedophile. Don't take classes from them.
We got some advice for you, kids. Don't be a pedophile.
I mean, the blacksmith guys, don't try not to take a class from a pedophile. Just do your best. I don't know how you fucking source that out, but do your best.
Right. Okay. We've got some moral dilemmas just after this.
Knife Talk is sponsored by Evenheat, the manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com.
Okay. Excuse me. Moral dilemmas. This is from Anonymous. He says, you're having a newsletter sale with several potential buyers. A guy offers you a higher amount than your asking price to buy directly and not make it to a random draw amongst all potential buyers. Do you take the money? And if you take the money, do you then communicate that openly, or do you keep it between the buyer and yourself? And that's from Anonymous. I'm not quite sure what he means here, because he says this is a newsletter sale. But then he's on about asking a higher amount.
But it must be a lottery. Like, yeah, it must be a lottery
kind of thing.
And then it's a set price. Everyone's in the lottery. And now I'm assuming it's a free lottery. Like, you wouldn't
yeah, you're not paying for a spot.
$25
yeah, yeah.
And then you fucking give it to Junior for the whole title. You know, it's a.
Yeah, yeah.
It's what do you think?
Usually those are first option of refusal or first right of refusal kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a strange one, because to me, if you've got a newsletter, you just send it out, then it's first buys, first gets. And if that was the case, if somebody contacted you beforehand, you, well, yeah, I'd say, yeah, you take the money, because, you know,
Yeah, it's,
that's what more, it's a business.
The but, moral dilemmas you're telling everybody it's this fair lottery
in
system.
In this case, put it out there and told everybody it's a lottery.
Right, and then you're and then it's not a lottery, and you're giving it to the guy with the high with a price that's like way more than it would be otherwise.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I don't know why you'd do it that way, but if you did, I think once it's out there, you put it out there publicly that it's going to be a lottery. I think it needs to be, to be honest with you. I mean, don't take the money.
I think the reason people go that lottery route, like the Bloodroot Blade guys, they're down in Georgia, and they put out a certain number of knives every month or every couple months or something like that, and they sell them via lottery because they have such high demand. And from all over the world... that they're trying to make it as fair as possible. Now, they do limit like the window that you have to essentially submit your interest in a particular knife before then they start randomly drawing. But unless you have like that kind of demand, I don't really see much of a use for the lottery system instead of just doing a first come first serve, which helps
seems
to
like
prevent
a lot,
this
seems
kind
like
of
a lot of work.
Yeah,
it seems like a lot. If you say that, you know, 6 p.m. there's going to be a drop, the newsletter's going out, first come first serve. You know, it seems a lot easier than the extra work of a lottery.
Sure. Within the confines of this conversation, I know who Anonymous is.
Okay.
And I would not question their decisions. This is like this is a serious dude.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I'm sure
the motherfucker knows what he's doing.
Trust he's clearly me. Got huge demand, so he
fucker
clearly
knows
does.
What he's
yeah,
doing,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not Neil Kamimura. I don't want you to think it was Neil. But
I mean, what do you think, Jeff?
I know what I'd do. Well, number one is if I say it's a lottery, it's a lottery. That's number one.
Sure.
I'm not gonna fucking there's a couple of things. If you wanted to do the non-moral dilemma, you just take the money and just don't say anything. You don't have to tell everybody everything. I do believe you don't have to tell everybody everything. But at the same time, me personally, as a person of like, I have to sleep at night, I would not be able to. I would say that, here's what I'd say to the guy. I'm like, look, here's what I'll do for you. I'll make you the exact same knife or a little bit better or a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
Do the lottery and then take the fucking commission from the guy. That's what I would do. That's exactly what I would do. I'd be like, why don't we just get the horse and the cow for free? Isn't that the expression?
The horse and the cow for free.
Why do you drink
never heard that before. But...
Wait, isn't it? Why would you drink the cow? Would drink the milk when you get the cow for free? Isn't that what it is?
Why would you buy the cow if you get the milk for free?
If you own the cow, then you get the milk. Get the fucking milk and the cow. Anonymous, get the fucking milk, get the fucking cow.
Get the milk, get the cow.
Get the milk and the goddamn cow. Get all the cows.
No,
That's what I would do.
Yeah, no, I agree with Jeff's move. Would be
milk
to keep it the lottery, but then speak directly with this person. If you're willing and open to doing a custom build, and do them a build. It's obviously they're willing to pay a premium for expediting, so sure. I mean, but ultimately you got to come down. I think it comes down to you and where you're at, and if you like you need the money or whatever, you got to do what's right for you. But I have a follow-up dilemma.
Go ahead.
After this. No, Jeff or Craig, would you do it? Would you?
Oh, he's taking that money. You know that.
No, I've already said if you already put it out there that it is a lottery, I think then you know, it's out there. It's a lottery.
Okay.
You know, as simple as that. But yeah, you do that, then you then say, well, look, we can do one anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be a custom order. But yeah, I don't understand that whole lottery thing. I don't see why you would.
At some point, this maker community should start thinking of themselves more like a metal shop and running jobs. I was talking to David. I just got back from the bakery. We're working on one collaboration. We've just finalized the third one, and I'm going to run everything through this job at the same time. And it's like, I was telling him that back in the day, we'd be running railings. We wouldn't be working on one railing, and then once it's done, then we'd take on the next one. There would be someone who had to organize the time to keep the ball rolling because the payroll's coming, and then the bills are coming, and you have to kind of constantly be ahead of the production of the shop. So
step back a minute. So you mean like a production line? So you
a production in the sense of like you have to keep the wheels spinning all the time. So it's not like it's why not just, you know, put him back. I do the lottery, do a deal with the guy, and even maybe knock off 5% just to keep his interest. Make him something different. Give him a couple new options and then run it through the shop. You know, I'm a huge fan. I think the biggest problem is, and this is might be a dilemma that a lot of knife makers are seeing. A lot of these guys have never worked in production shops or metal shops. And they kind of feel as though where they're waiting for people to come to them. Like this whole Instagram thing, it seems as though everybody's waiting for Instagram to work for them. I drove to this bakery 4 times to just kind of hammer out this deal. You know, it's like you kind of have to do things on your own. You kind of have to make things happen no matter what, because waiting for something to happen is for the birds. It's not business 101. Waiting for someone, hoping that somebody comes through, you got to fucking make it happen.
Right, but
get to the bakery, get the donuts. Yeah,
got to make the donuts, baby.
And then drop them off at the post office. I would say, though, that if somebody's just starting out or just starting to get traction, jumping into a production situation is not necessarily, I don't think it would be necessarily the greatest idea, because what happens when somebody is like takes the advice and they go to New Jersey Steel Baron, they pick out a steel, they have it laser cut, and they have all the shit, they have all this handle materials, they have it all sent to them, they do all this work, they have this massive surplus of inventory, but then they don't have the demand yet. I think it's a progression thing. You got to get to a point when you have the demand to then start stepping into doing this production stuff.
What's your opinion of what production is?
I think production is less sentimental. And that's what I was starting to get to, is that I think a lot of these makers, knife making is a practice in a way. It's a way to express their own personal creativity through this form. And there's a lot of sentimentality for a lot of makers or a lot of people who are listening to our shows and who are doing this work. And I think that it's hard to separate that sentimentality from the work when it's your way of stepping away from the day job or taking a break from the family just for like some you time to be in the shop and grind on a blade or forge some steel or forge a blade, whatever the fuck you're doing. And so separating off that sentimentality makes it kind of sterile in a way, or more robotic and systematized, which when it comes to high production, when you have that demand, fucking totally makes sense to separate that so that you're pumping out product, getting it to the world, getting that money and putting it back in, and you continue the cycle like you're talking about. But I think not everybody is at that level where they need to step into that mindset. Because for them, it's still, even for me, this is still a very sentimental process where I'm going through this work. Now, I have pieces in the shop that I pull in and I just slam out because I just don't care, because I need to get paid. And those have less sentimentality. But when it's an important piece to me sentimentally, because I developed a new process, or this is the first time I put out this type of pattern, like it's a little bit more difficult to separate that sentimentality from the work. I guess my definition for production versus whatever else is just there's a lack of sentimentality to it. You're doing a job. You're running through these jobs and producing work and getting it out to the world as quickly as you can and as efficiently as you can so that you can
just get going to clarify again. I think sentimentality is a vague term.
In the past, I feel like you said that was sentimental.
I think that your opinion and my opinion on what sentimental is different, because at the same time, when you're an artist and you have a degree of sentimentality, what you get is you lose a little bit of your desire to get better. If you think it ain't going to get better than this. If it ain't going to get better than this, if you think that this is the best knife I've made and it's never going to get better than that, that's a problem. That's a problem. So I don't...
Doesn't it mean that you care deeply for it, though?
When Mareko says sentimentality, what it makes me think is maybe he thinks that certain things mean more to certain people than others. So, I mean, my work, it means a lot to me. The body of my work means a lot to me. And when I say production... I'm only doing a batch of 10, and it matters to me. But at the same time, I know that I'm going to do the best I can on this job, and I care about doing it. and I know that the next ones are going to be better. Am I being sentimental? I believe that sentimentality can kill your desire to get better.
Interesting.
I don't agree. Actually, I don't.
Okay, so don't agree. So let's hear it. Here, let's hear you not agree. So say something.
No, like I said, I think if you are, I'm not saying that you don't care deeply about what you make, but I'm saying if you care deeply about what you make, it doesn't mean that you don't the next thing you want to be you don't want to be better. It just means that you're falling in love again with the next thing again. That's very sort of me, that sort of tunnel vision on that one particular thing that I'm doing is the most important thing. Obviously, I want the next one to be better each time. It is a difficult one because I suppose it depends what people think by the word sentimentality. To me, it's all about how I feel about something and how... I think I just described it.
My father is the best painter I ever met, and he coveted his work. He coveted his work, and he never wanted to let anything go, and he had his favorites. He was stifled by that, like, he didn't feel like he could let it go because he loved this, you know, this some of this work so much. And I felt as though, and he and I had conversations later in life, that it did stunt him creatively-wise because he felt like it ain't going to get better than this. So in regards to that, I mean, look, I don't even really consider myself doing production anything. If I'm doing a batch of 10 here and 15 there, that's not really production. But at the same time, when we get these questions, they're business oriented. We never get the questions. We rarely get the questions that are like, you know, we get a question like this one is about newsletters, like newsletter etiquette. So, I mean, I don't know. At some point, we're going to have to talk about what your definition of sentimentality is and it isn't.
Well, I think I'm seeing, especially hearing you follow up. So I think for what you're talking about in regards to sentimentality and somebody's lack of willingness to let something go because they're afraid it might be the best thing ever. I definitely don't have that. And because to me, that's more of like a fixed mindset versus a growth mindset. And this author, Carol Dweck, wrote a really great book about growth mindset and stuff like that. But essentially the concept is that, and I think I grew up actually with a very fixed mindset in the way that I was like, I'm only good at things that I'm good at the first time I try them. And if I'm not good at it, then I need to move the fuck on and find the thing somewhere, wherever it is, where the growth mindset says, huh, I'm not good at this thing, but I'm interested in this enough to keep failing until I get it right. And so there's like this belief that in yourself, and I don't know if that's cultural or if that comes from family or just natural with innate within a person, but I think there's a difference there in mindset. For me, I'm very sentimental in regards to the work because especially special pieces that are kind of a one-off, very special one-off, unique patterns. First time I do a certain handle style or something like that, because to me it's part of my growth as a creative person, as an artist or maker. That is a very clear definition from one point, and then everything after is going to have somewhat of that influence of that particular thing, like this kind of Art Deco faceted handle I did a couple months ago. But at the same time, I'm willing to let it go because in my mind, I know where I can make improvements and I know where I can make changes that I'm interested in trying out and experimenting with. And that's where that growth mindset plays in. But sentimentally to me, that is a very important point or piece to me. And there are several of those along my path and my journey as a knife maker that I'm very sentimental about. And I wish I could keep that piece because it was a big transition for me, I guess. And then for me, I can continue to move forward with the idea that I can continue to grow and develop as more skill and knowledge and techniques and whatever the fuck as a maker. But if I'm fixed, then I would see that handle and I'd be like, holy shit, that's the best thing I've ever made. I'm never going to be able to do that again. And I would never sell anything. So I think if I'm going to be successful as a business person in this craft or any craft really, or whatever you do, you got to have that willingness to let go and that willingness to know or see yourself in as a able to and available to learn, to grow as you continue to move forward as a creative person. I don't know if that helped better clarify my position on sentimentality.
Kind of clarified it.
Yeah.
Did you have a follow-up question to the before we went on our escapade off-roading it?
Oh, me? Rec-
yeah, you said you had a follow-up question.
Oh, yeah. So this whole situation is around a raffle. So I am aware of a maker who did an auction, and that's what I would be curious what you guys' thoughts are. If you're auctioning a thing and it's posed to be a very special, very one of a fucking kind thing, and then you sell it, it sells for thousands of dollars, and then the second place person's like, oh, I was so close. And then the maker says, you know what? I'll make you one. What do you think of that?
If it's auctioned as a special one-off piece, I think that's a bit shady.
But if you said you make something similar.
Yeah, and I think if it's... Yeah, particularly if it's something for charity as well, I suppose that may sort of blur the lines a bit. Yeah, I suppose it's, it depends on how that was worded, that initial auction, I suppose.
Yeah.
When I was doing the Cuban knives with Carl Ruiz, and Carl Ruiz died, we stopped the design. Stopped it.
Yeah.
Just completely stopped it. And the same day we found out that he died, I said, well, the ones that are, you know, scheduled to go out, that's it. And I had the opportunity, a lot of money was put in front of me. Enough money that it was just like, it wasn't hard for me to say no. But it was just like, you know, I could have been in the Carl Ruiz business for a while. And we made the decision, we're just not doing it, and that's just the end of it. And they also felt as though that if that's the best I can do, then I got a real problem.
Sure.
So in regards to that situation, I would... You know, I would reach out to that person and say, if you want me to make you something, I can totally make you something. But I wouldn't, I would say, I can't make you the same thing. Guy wanted me to make the Cuban knife, and he was just like, it's got to be like the Cuban knife. And I said, I can make you something not similar to, but it will be a very, you know, something that we've done that's the closest to it. And it really was quite far away, but, yeah, I think you got to have a little bit of inner fortitude on the moral clarity, and just I wouldn't, because then you're cheapening the first guy too.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Because they think they're getting something special, one of a kind. I mean, that would feel pretty shitty to be like, oh, he ended up turning around making another one. Cool.
Yeah. So when something's labeled as one of a kind, it really just sort of draw a line under what you can do then, doesn't it? I mean, how much of a change does it need to be for that to be ethically good, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, changing a color, slightly changing a pattern or something, it's always going to be slightly murky, I think.
No. Yeah.
Okay. Well, what are we? 52 minutes in, we've done one question.
That's my goal.
Wowzers.
That's my goal.
Wowzers.
That's my goal. That's the goal.
Okay, back in a second.
Combat Abrasives makes the world's best abrasive belts for knife makers. Available in any size at unbelievable prices. Go take a look at combatabrasives.com and get 15% off with promo code KNIFETALK15.
Do it now. Okay, who's taking the next one?
I'll take one from the bottom. This is from Nick Alpin. I was going to read it Nico. Sorry. Nick Alpin. It says, hey, guys.
Nick.
Hey, guys. Executed my first cryo today, ABL, in kerosene and dry ice. Previously used kitchen freezer before. Aiming for consistency and repeatability results before, A, making my first sale, and two, working on a pricier steel. Two questions. I used a Walmart styrofoam cooler that seemed to leak kerosene. Is that expected? Would you or listeners have a container recommendation? And then second question is, knives stay pretty warm for a while after temper cycles. Is there a recommendation on how long to wait after the first cycle? Any any harm? Is there any harm in using a fan to cool them, so I can check for straightness? Cheers from Florida, Neek. Okay, so issues. Have you guys? So he's doing a what's generally referred to as dryo cold treatment, or as Dr. Laren Thomas refers to it as a sub-zero treatment, but not necessarily a cryo.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've done plenty of sub-zeros literally using freezers. I've only done cryo once, so I'm not really the best person to answer that. I know Jeff does a lot more of that now. So Jeff, what are you keeping your... Well, first of all, are you using kerosene at any point?
No, I'm not doing that dry ice kerosene thing because it's just... I got a Dewar from Rick Dunkerley years ago, and it's just... Getting the dry ice and the liquid nitrogen is the same place. And it's like, it just seemed as though liquid nitrogen was a better move. I don't know anything about styrofoam coolers and I don't know anything about styrofoam coolers and kerosene, frankly.
Sure.
It makes me nervous. All that stuff makes me nervous. And I would never give a recommendation for like some sort of, you know, oh, don't worry, you know, this chemical doesn't fucking touch that. I don't really have anything to do with that kind of thing, so I wouldn't really know where to go. I would be very, very cautious, especially listening to like a podcast on, you know, kerosene and styrofoam and dry ice. I don't know enough about it. Sure. In regards to question number two, or we can do one at a time. So what's your opinion, anybody on the Walmart styrofoam cooler expecting leak kerosene?
Yeah, I've done the dryo. I don't have a Dewar. And so when I've done, especially like Damasteel, I've done the denatured alcohol in a styrofoam cooler with dry ice. And that gets it down to, I think it's negative 110 or 120. And from what I understand, based on the data sheets from Damasteel and from some of the articles that Laren Thomas has posted, that's a pretty good treatment. But anyways, it was only on the last one that when I did the denatured alcohol with the dry ice that after, because once I do it, it's just like sitting there. I don't pour it back into a container or anything. It's just kind of like done and laying on the shop floor while I'm doing other stuff. And the last time I noticed that the styrofoam container had like it had leaked or something overnight or whatever. I came in the next day and there's just not kerosene but the denatured alcohol everywhere. Thankfully that wasn't necessarily the biggest issue on a concrete floor, but I was surprised to see it. So I think in the future, if I'm going to go that route, I'll make sure that it's in a secondary container of probably just like a hotel pan or something like that, in case it does want to leak out, so that it's at least still somewhat contained. Or just put it back in the thing, and then I don't know, because there's all kinds of gunk and stuff that ends up being in it afterward too. So that would be my advice, is just to back it up. But I've had good success with the styrofoam coolers, but except for the most recent one. Okay, that's what I got.
Yeah, and what was the
The second question was, knives stay pretty warm for a while after temper cycles. Is there a recommendation on how long to wait after first cycle? Any harm in using a fan to cool them so I can check for straightness?
What do you think, Greg?
That's a good question. I don't know. So we're always told that, you know, to temper, don't let things cool down too much before you put in for your first temper cycle. Yeah, but between those temper cycles, generally, I would, just because of the scheduling, the way I do things, I try and do a heat treat and a first temper in the first day, and then I do a second temper the second day. So it would be completely cold. But I'm just wondering whether there's any harm in that, and, you know, as the question suggests, really, or whether they should go in for a second temper while still warm, or, well, I mean, what are you thinking?
What do you think, Jeff?
When we had Dr. Laren Thomas on here, he said there was no, you could quench in between tempering. in water. That if you pull it, okay. If the temper's right. finished, it doesn't, there was no data that there was any difference if you just like take it out of the oven and then put it in some water and then throw it back in. He said,
because you're not at a high enough temperature for it to really matter
so
said,
much. He said, I remember very clearly, he said there wasn't any evidence to there being any difference between waiting for it to dry, waiting for it to cool down on its own, or quench it. So,
yeah,
that's my thoughts. I've done it like when we do the class and we had to do, you know, I didn't want to be waiting until these little friction folders were done. I didn't want to wait. I quenched them all and put them back in the oven.
Right.
Yeah. There's nothing happening to the steel
right.
during that quench because say it's not, you know, at those super, super high temperatures. That makes sense. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So obviously if you can quench it, then there shouldn't be an issue with using a fan. What was the other part of the question? See, while pretty warm. All right, so pretty warm after temper cycles. Is there recommendations on how long to wait after first cycle? Any harm in using a fan? So he can check for straightness. So I would definitely. Well, I guess he's saying after the first temper cycle to check for straightness. But I would maybe wait until your second time. I was checking for straightness on a Damasteel blade that was still pretty high in hardness, and I'm trying to remember now if it was before the first temper cycle or after, but I fucking popped off 2.5 inches right off the tip of the fucking thing. That became a little shorty after that. So you definitely, and with ABL is pretty tough steel, so it should be fine as long as you've tempered it one time through. But yeah, just know to be cautious when kind of, if you're doing any bending or prying processes to try to straighten it.
Make sure it's at least one good temper cycle. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, whilst we're talking about Damasteel, I hope everybody's got their steel for the build along. So for those who don't know, Damasteel is a super, super cool stainless Damascus. They do amazing patterns. And every year we do these build alongs. And they're partnering up with Maritime Knife Supply this year. Lawrence at Maritime Knife Supply. Where he is providing it. So you can go there and you can buy a Damasteel directly from him for the build along. That's maritimeknifesupply.com. As well as the Damasteel, he does everything else. Steel, belts, handle materials, tools, forges, kilns. Everything you need for the build along, you can get from Lawrence at maritimeknifesupply.com. So go take a look.
The other thing is we got a message from Carly that somebody was asking about the heat treatment scheduling for the.
We're not doing more admin for Carly, is it? Is this becoming
Dude,
a regular
you,
slot?
Do you want
to
know what she? Do you want to know what she wrote in the Damasteel? She told I. You know what? Carly's about to get it. So Carly wrote in the Instagram chat. She wrote to me. She said, "I'll keep sending questions for the build along. No need to thank me." sending you more work. You're welcome. So, Carly's playing games. But yeah. Somebody, I think Sunday Knives asked about the heat treatment, and basically, for this piece of Drakkar, Carly said that the steel is DS93X, which the data sheet is linked in the bio of Damasteel. So the heat treatment schedule is with the Damasteel. DS. Yeah.
That's something with Damasteel, actually. So Damasteel.se, they've got all the heat treatment all laid out there for you as well. So yeah, go take a look at their site because if you've never used it before, they make it super, super simple. Okay, Nord.artisan. He contacted us on Instagram. We are Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. Any questions, DM us. And that's exactly what Nord.artisan did. And that's Sven. He says, "Hey guys, love the show. You sometimes talk about fixing knives that a customer misused, like putting in the dishwasher and so on. So how do you handle this monetarily? Do they pay for the repair and shipping, or do you handle it all for free as part of a customer service? I'm overseas, so shipping is a big, big price point. Cheers, Sven." That's a good one. And I know both of you do a lot of this as well. So, you know, spa days, as Morocco calls them, and you know, fixing wherever it may be. How do you handle that? Do you charge for it? Do you only charge for the shipping? I mean, what's the deal?
Yeah, I only ask the customer to pay for the cost of the shipping.
Even if it's maybe been in a dishwasher or it's been misused?
Yeah, well, okay, so one that I did a while back, it was pretty beat the fuck up. But that lady happened to live in my town, where I live, so she just handed it off to me.
Threw it at your house. Drove by and just like
a fucking paper
threw
boy.
It at the door.
But yeah, it was pretty rough. And it was definitely a 2-3 days of work to kind of regrind it and sculpt everything down and rehand sand things and get a good etch and finish on it and fix the handle and stuff. But I don't know that I don't know if I'm doing it the right way. I think there can be tiers. Like if somebody's just looking for a Damascus knife to just be re-etched, or even if it's a mustard finish or forced patina, I think that's a pretty light work. But when you start into getting into this is going to be a whole day of work or a couple days of work, probably if I was a better business person, probably should be charging for that time. But I don't know. For whatever reason, I have a hard time doing that. And maybe it's just because I'm not a good business person. But I think there are certain things that, as the maker, you know, I think you want your work to look good and continue to look good over its life. And I guess that kind of comes back to that sentimentality in a way, because for me, my work out there with my name on it is partially like a representation of my sense of commitment to that work, to that piece and what it looks like and how it performs and all that stuff. And usually over time and multiple sharpenings, those knives also need to be re-thinned, because it's just... as you remove material and sharpening, you're getting up into thicker and thicker cross section of the knife. And so that work needs to be done. But yeah, I think personally, you gotta take into consideration what time you have available to do this on top of all the stuff you're already doing, whether it's family, a full-time job, or you're doing this full-time. And then, yeah, I think it's totally up to you if you want to charge just a flat service fee or whatever you want to charge, even if it's nothing. I would at least ask them to pay for the shipping, though, because especially if it's international, that's going to be a bear. Can be. That's probably going to be at least a couple $100, right?
Well, yeah, it can be. Certainly can be, yeah. Jeff, what are you thinking?
It's interesting because, once again, because it's a shop and I see this as a business, there's an expression that my business partner Tony used to say to me, which was, that's the cost of doing business. Like that you can't, everything cannot be, in a business, everything cannot be net positive all the time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes customer service means you got to do something every so often. Now, I had a guy who sent me a knife, and this motherfucker put it to the dishwasher, I ate a lot. But he was a good dude, and he bought a pile of knives, and I sold another one to him. I'm like, I'll take care of you. I feel sometimes good customer service goes a longer way than nickel and diming somebody for everything. You know, usually, like, if we have something, what happens is I don't get a lot of those. I mean, every 3 months, somebody will say, yeah, can you sharpen this knife for me? And I'll say, I will sharpen. You send it to me, I'll send it back. Now, here comes the problem with the little shipping and stuff like that. For me to bill these people, all of a sudden there's these weird little, oh, we got to charge them sales tax for this. And then they're in this state. And sometimes it's like not worth the fucking headache, you know. So I usually will say to someone, because it doesn't happen very often. I'm like, just send it, I'll take care of you. And usually that extends some really good... You know, it's good PR, really. It's good.
Sure. Yeah,
someone saying Fader's going to take care of me. Don't worry. When it comes down to it, Fader's going to take care of me. Now, when it comes to overseas, yeah, I would say, all right, yeah, you pay for it to come over here, and I'll pay for it to go back. I would do. That's probably what I would do. Maybe not. Maybe I would say you pay it to ship it over and pay it to go back. If it was like, you know, because for us to send it to Europe, it's like probably like $60, $50 each way, I would say. So
you need to start doing what Toma does. and send him off to Toma and get Toma to do your work for you.
You know what? He does that to me. You know that
exactly,
Toma does that to
exactly.
me.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, actually,
yes.
That makes a lot of sense too, because there have been a lot of knife makers who've asked me to repair jobs for them when their knives are overseas, and I generally say no, because a lot of makers do things differently than I do. So, like, I remember doing one for fucking Kev from Australia. Did I ever tell you that cheeky fucking story? So he says to me, Kev Slattery, I know that I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again. So Kev Slattery says to me, he's like, hey, mate, I have this customer.
G'day, mate.
Yeah, g'day, mate. I have this customer who dropped this knife with whatever, you know, giggery or I don't know what the fuck.
A flaming galah.
Yeah, some fucking hoochie poochie or I don't know what the fuck kind of Australian lumber it was. And he says, you think you could, he's got a crack in it. You think you could fix it just like a ding? And I say, absolutely, no problem. For you, Kev, for you, as long as I can break your balls for the rest of your life, 100%. So then the guy has got a laundry list of things for me to do afterwards, which I kind of didn't agree to. But at the same time, it is Kev. And I'm just like, all right, I'll take care of you. And I told Kev, I'm like, your man's asking for a lot, but I'm putting it on your bill of ball breaking. I'm putting it on the ball breaking bill. And then the guy started saying, I need you to sharpen it. I need you to do this. I need you to do that. And I fucking took care of it. The guy never even gave me a thank you. And not that I need to be thanked all the time, but it was just like, I didn't give him a bill.
Yeah.
I didn't give a bill. I took care of him. I did it right. I just relentlessly kicked Kev's teeth in for a while. And it was like, it's kind of worth it. But with Tomer, I've worked with Tomer's. I built his knives before. I built a pile of his knives before. So I feel comfortable for the fact that I can fix them to the point where I had to completely rebuild a handle. And that was no problem. I've made a pile of his knives. I know his process. I could quit here. I could go to work for him in a heartbeat. I know how to make his knives. That's a different story. But like if somebody wanted me to fix Don Nguyen's knife or Mareko's knife, I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole because I just don't think that I could do what they wanted done.
I think you make a good point about the fact that this stuff doesn't happen very often. And I think that's part of the reason that I've continued to just do it pro bono, or at least, you know, ask them to cover the cost of shipping, but take my time and do it, because I think I've had maybe 5 or 6 knives over the last 11 years come back to be repaired or to have a spa day. So that, I think that's probably the biggest reason that I keep doing it without charging people, even though when I'm doing it, I piss and moan the whole time and complain. But at the same time, the last time I had done one was like 3 years ago. So I just shut the fuck up and just do it. Because what Jeff was saying, he does make a good point about, the high quality customer service and taking care of your customers, potentially could turn into potentially business down the road. Somebody refers you to them, then that's some of like, well, if, I guess people who are struggling with the Instagram stuff, then that's possibly another way to help build your audience, is to just take good care of the customers you already got, and then they might refer people to you in the future.
You gotta fucking take care of your customers. It's the best. It's the cheapest PR of all time. Cheapest PR.
Zero. Was it cost to acquisition? They call it, don't they? The cost of getting a new customer.
But I mean, that expression, the cost of doing business, is sometimes you just, you know, you're not going to be in the black all the time. You got to do certain things, and you shouldn't have to. You know, my old boss John Johnson used to say, "You can't make every job a career." As in, you know, that was a union thing, and these union guys would go on these job sites and they would just drag their feet to kind of stay on this one job because they wanted to get as much money out of it as possible. And he used to say, don't make a job a career. And that was really very interesting to me in terms of the idea of, like, sometimes you don't have to think too hard. Sometimes you just got to get it out the door and on to the next thing. And, you know, I think it's very important.
Okay, I think it's Mr. C Customs or MRC Customs. Says, sup, boys? Thanks for the feedback from my last question. It really helped a lot. My question this week, this is a weekly question now. My question this week is for Jeff, since he is based in my area. Are there any specific markets or fairs in the tri-state area you would recommend getting a booth at? My goal is to do a few of these shows this summer and would appreciate any feedback or guidance. Thank you all for helping me improve the craft each and every week.
I'm very impressed, Mr. Customs, because I think it's great that you want to be involved. The two things that I know of, there's the New York Knife Show. I think it's in Long Island. I think it's in Jersey City.
I think it also just happened.
It just happened. And then the next one, which I think might have also happened, is the Mystic Knife Show. What I would suggest is get on board with Matt Parkinson. Matt Parkinson runs the Mystic Knife Show in Connecticut.
Yeah.
He's very involved. He and I talked about it last year in regards to his involvement. He's very involved in that.
Nice.
There are these guilds around that are very they're really good. I don't know in regards to the summer. I'm not 100% sure, but the only two shows that I do know of is that the New York Knife Show and the Mystic Knife Show. Around here, and that's all I can think of. Mareka, you know any East Coast shows?
No, those are the only ones I know of.
Okay,
yeah,
all right. I'm impressed. This guy, I'm waiting for someone to say, "Hey, listen, let's put together a table and get a booth at the fancy food show in the Javits Center." That's the fucking move. Don't go where everyone's
New York
selling
food
knives.
Wine or something like that.
Well, the fancy food show is the biggest food convention show in the United States. It's at the Javits Center. It's where all the restaurant people go, and companies come from. They pay you pay $1,500 for a booth, and then you're just jammed with people for days and days.
Oh,
and days.
Yeah.
So
yeah, captive audience $500 a pop.
Well, I don't know about captive audience. They like most of it's freebies. Most of the people who you're making connections, and so people want freebies. No one's buying stuff. You're making connections. Basically, it would be like let's say you make pans, and then you meet a restaurant guy, and then the restaurant guy would do a deal with you. So you're doing deals. You're not selling shit on the floor. You're kind of making networking connections.
Okay.
Fair enough. Okay, now's a good time to tell everybody about Texas Farrier Supply, which is texasfarriersupply.com. Everything you need as a maker, they've got it, including Indasa Rhino-Wet. If you've never used Indasa Rhino-Wet, it is the sandpaper of the superstars. It's going to save you time and save you money. I mean, how boring is it talking about sandpaper? But I promise you, it is so great to use. It'll just change your mind about hand sanding. So yeah, go to texasfarriersupply.com, fill up your basket with Indasa Rhino-Wet and anything else that they've got in stock, because we can get you 10% off using Knife Talk 10 at checkout. So head on over to texasfarriersupply.com.
Them Texas Farrier Supply boys got that gator piss.
Ah, there we go.
Gator short for alligator, and piss is short for urine. Gator piss. That's the slug line I'm trying to get Koi to say from now on.
Really?
Yeah.
And piss is short for urine.
Yeah. Gator is short for alligator, and piss is short for urine. Gator piss. I like this.
What's E.T. short for?
E.T.? Extraterrestrial. Yeah.
No, because he got little legs.
What? What? Well, I don't get it.
What's E.T. short for? Because he's got little legs.
You motherfucker, you. That's good. I didn't get that. Was good. That was good. Good, good, good. Well, let's hit this one and then we'll get the fuck out of here or whatever.
Yeah, come on.
This comes from Justin Stout. Here's a great question. I'm saying that. Hey, guys.
Jacob Stout.
Hey,
Jacob Stout.
What did I say?
Justin.
Oh, Jacob Stout. Sorry, Justin. Just kidding. Sorry, Jake. Jacob Stout. Jacob Stout says... I'm still getting over E.T. got that short leg. hey, guys. You know what, you son of a bitch? Now, all of a sudden, I really get it. Hey, guys. New fan of the podcast here. I'm in an unusual situation, and I'm wondering what you guys think. I've recently happened into a full-time production knife-making job. My boss used to run a distribution for a well-known local knife maker. The knife maker retired, and my boss bought the business off of him. rights to the name and the design, existing customer base, and some of the equipment. The knife maker has since moved away and fallen out of contact with my boss. And now I've found myself basically in charge of this small workshop with no prior experience and no one to teach me. But I'm eager to learn and have some success in doing my own research. In addition, I get paid by the knife, so efficiency is a big concern. I don't really have a specific question, but I wonder what advice you would have for me.
It sounds like a dilemma.
That's a dilemma.
Yeah. Wow.
That's a tough spot.
Buckle up, my guy.
I think the your boss that bought the business kind of fucked up. Sorry if he's listening. But he should have had it written in the contract that he had to fucking stay until he trained your ass up.
Yeah.
Well, you don't know, but you don't know.
What an opportunity for you, too, thinking of it that way.
If he bought the name and everything else, they must have had something in place. And then maybe, who knows, maybe he just couldn't. Maybe he learned how to do it, but he just couldn't. There's a lot of different things that could have happened in this situation.
You get your boss to pay for classes at the New England School of Metalwork or Johnstown at the CMA. That's what you do.
Well, I don't think those classes were going to help him learn how to run a production shop. And I think that you're going to get more information out of a metalworking shop than a concept shop. I personally believe that a lot of these, especially these kinds of situations, there's tricks and tips. My last shop, we were doing these elevator rails. There are these railings that get bolted into an elevator so a cart doesn't bump into the wall. And we could train someone how to make them, and there was like 5 or 6 easy steps to get you there. And I think you're going to have to start to really think about this business in that way. Now, I think you might have to hire someone to come in as like a consultant to help you get yourself squared away, because...
Jeff, fishing for
not
work.
Me. Fuck me. Jacob.
I think what you need is to hire somebody to come in. And...
If this was my situation, I would be like, I can't just go take a class. I got to get someone in here and figure out how to do this. Because there's going to be, especially if you've never worked in metalwork. I mean, reading a book isn't going to show you how to work whatever machine he's got.
Yeah. By the sounds of it, you've got specific designs as well that you're doing rather than, you know, creating your own stuff as well. So it would be all about process there, surely.
Oh my God, I think Mareko's right. I think your boss puts you in a bad spot, man. My guy. Hmm.
A hell of an opportunity, maybe.
You're gonna have to knuckle up. I mean, some of them first knives are not gonna look like the ones that the fucking original dude made. You know,
I'd be curious because it sounds like he knows some of the process already. I'd be curious what parts he needs to understand better or get better at.
Knocking him out because he's getting paid by the knife. Yeah. If he's getting paid by the knife.
Maybe that's why that guy bailed. He's like, I know, I'm going to leave, and then I'll make them pay me more to come back and train that fucking guy.
And this motherfucker walked. Because boy, my old boy left. He just fucked away off. He did the old Irish goodbye. Left. That's a bad spot. I think you're in a bad position. I mean, I would hate to be in a position of having to run a new business that no one was there to train. You got to find someone to help you figure out how to retrain you.
I'd be curious to see this work. I tried looking him up on Instagram, but I don't see anything.
Well, yeah, he's just new at it. There's no fucking knife on his thing.
Right.
I would.
Yeah, we don't. We don't know how much experience he has.
No, we don't. Well, he said he's new at it.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, are there online resources maybe that people that he could look to? Or YouTube channels that he might be able to follow that kind of go through some of the various processes. Like there's Trollsky has a really good page, right? It's not necessarily production, but some of his processes suit production work, don't they?
But you know what the fucked up thing is? Is they're making this dude's knives.
Right.
So how do you train someone to make the knives that people are expecting to get from the original guy?
Mm.
You know, because that guy's gone. And that guy's a dick. You know, it's like, let's just be clear. That guy's a dick. If Fader knives get sold, and in my mind, I'm reading this podcast, I'm reading this question, and my fingers are crossed, like, that's what I want. However, I will have something in a contract saying that the stuff that you're producing with my name on it are at a certain standard.
So sentimental, Jeff.
No, but I mean, you don't want your name dragged through the mud.
No, true. Yes.
You know, I mean, at the same time, it's just like I can say, Like, I can say I got nothing to do with this anymore. You know, I'll change my last name anyway. You know, that,
like, you change your fucking name.
Yeah, I can go with my mother's maiden name. I'm not mad at St. John. I could be Jeff St. John. I'm worried about it. No problem. I mean, my wife won't like it because all of a sudden she's like, I just changed my last name 25 years ago. I didn't do it again. But I mean,
third time lucky.
It is a dilemma because that fucking guy, he left with the name of his business in somebody else's hands and didn't really like give you any situation where you could help these people. That's some horseshit, isn't it?
Yeah. You're not in a good spot, but this, you could see it as an opportunity. Yeah. Give us more details. Send us more details.
Jacob, here's what you're going to do. You're going to reach out to Steve Pellegrino. He will take his 57 Chevy and drive to your shop. He will fix everything. Steve, go over to Jacob Stout and get him squared away. Okay, Steve? You're done. Jacob, we got you, baby. Just kidding. Yep. He's not going anywhere.
Throwing Steve under the bus. Jeez.
Tight ass. You're not doing anything with tight ass jeans. Slick back hair, tight ass jeans. He ain't even helping you, Jacob. Steve Pellegrino ain't helping you. So I fucked them both. Sorry, guys.
Oh, jeez. Moving on.
Hey, yo. Don't clip that section.
Mareko, tell us all about your grinder and how that could help Jacob stand out.
I tell you, I love the Broadbeck because it's such a fucking versatile machine. God, it's like, what, like 7 or 8 different machines in one almost. But I was actually just using it for doing not only the handle sculpting on this Loveless knife, but also the museum fit-ups afterward. But anyways, I really love what these guys have done. Vince is a great guy, and Ryan's a great guy, and they're both makers who make who've made these grinders designed specifically for makers. And they have all kinds of package setups. They have all kinds of tool arms that you can get a hold of. And what's beautiful is that they are cross-platform. So say you already have a chassis. You don't need another chassis, but you need a surface grinding attachment or you need a disc grinding attachment. They got you covered. So go to BroadbeckIronworks.com. And when you go to checkout, make sure you put in Knife Talk 10 to save yourself 10%. Again, that's BroadbeckIronworks.com. Put in Knife Talk 10, you're going to save yourself a few ducats.
Jacob Stout, reach out to Brian House. This is a Brian House fix. I bet you Brian House would fix you up. That's what I would do. Call that maniac.
Oh, there we go. Okay, should we call it a day?
Yeah, let's call it a day.
I call it a day, okay. Okay, then. Okay, we're done.
There you go.
Poor Jacob. Holy shit.
Jacob, he'll be okay. Don't worry, he'll be okay. He's got enough time to listen to podcasts. So if he's got enough time to listen to podcasts, he'll be okay.
True. Quite
one
true.
One of the things that I wanted to kind of touch upon, I know this, you know, a friend of the show and a friend of mine, Dave Cardilla, passed away last week. A couple of weeks ago, I got told that he had been ill, and he was brought to the hospital, and then he was surrounded by his family, his wife and his family, and he had passed away. And it was shocking. It was very sad. It was tragic. He was a funny guy. He was a good guy. He used to come to the Hammer-Ins. I've known him for a while. And what I wanted to do is just, so DK Forge Works, we used to call him Damascus Dave. He used to send messages into the show. He would listen to the show. I remember one thing he used to do is when Craig used to play jingles, he fucking hated the jingles, and he would text me incessantly and say, you got to stop it with those jingles, Jeff. Tell Craig to stop it with those jingles. He was a big supporter of this show. And one of the things I just wanted to touch upon after that conversation about education is I met Dave before he ever swung a hammer, and he was at the Center for Metal Arts my second time when I was there helping them finish some projects up. And he was a student of John Ledford. He was a student of Uri Hoffe. He took all the classes. And then when John left and Pat came in, he helped transition Pat into the Center for Metal Arts. He was helpful. He took all the classes. And one of the interesting things about him is you don't normally get to say you've seen the career of a blacksmith from nothing to something special. And his eagerness to learn, especially from other people, transformed him into a very proficient blacksmith. He made all his own hammers, he made all his own tongs, he made all of his own tooling, and it's I feel very fortunate enough to be able to say that I knew him. We had a good time together, and I saw him. I saw his entire career, and he created it was an incredible amount of time that he spent building and becoming an extraordinarily good blacksmith. And I know he was an assistant to Peter Brasmanix. I know he was his assistant. He did stuff with our friend Mike Cataldo, and he was a great guy. And he'll be missed. It was a lot of ball breaking. And here's the funny thing, and I'm not going to get sentimental about it, but at the same time, there's a funny thing. We weren't supposed to say anything. They were very secretive. Dave didn't really want people to know, and that's fine. And I honored how I was told. I was like, don't say anything. I didn't say anything. So when he died, and I ended up talking to Jesse Savage, and I sent a message to Rick Barter, who was one of his closest friends, and he's totally devastated. I said something. I mentioned it to you guys, and that was pretty much it. And then I talked to John Ledford, I talked to Pat Quinn, and you know, we were kind of reminiscing about Dave. So I wasn't going to say anything, and then all of a sudden, I saw Rick Barter posted this beautiful tribute to Dave. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at this thing, and I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, he's wearing my fucking, there's all the pictures.
Yeah.
He's wearing my fucking shirt. Not only is he wearing a Fader Knife shirt, he's got the variety pack. So he's got like three different variations. So I'm like, now I got to say something. You know, it's like all of a sudden, like I fucking can't shut up. And now all of a sudden, so I kind of texted a little bit with his mother, and she's very grateful for this community. And I don't know what's going to happen this summer. Something's going to happen, I think, maybe. But, you know, look. It's very tragic. It's very sad. And Dave Cardillo was a fucking good dude. And I do have one last story. He was a king of the ball breakers, and I'm going to break his balls. So he became a really good a blacksmith. And then when he started making knives, and then he would send me questions, and I'd help him if I could. And he listened to this podcast, and he had a striking hammer. I say, why don't you make me a striking hammer? So he made me a striking hammer, and I just, at the same time, I'm like, I don't really do a lot of striking, but at the same time, I thought, I want him to make me in the hammer. So how's it going with the hammer? Oh, yeah, we're working on the hammer. So all of a sudden, I get this message, and he sends me a picture, and he goes, just to let you know, the cross peen is a little bit crooked. And I said, oh, that's okay. I mean, how bad can it be? He's like, well, it's just crooked. So I think to myself, all right, I said, no problem, because I'm just going to break your balls every time I see it and every time I see you. So he gives me the hammer, and it's fucking crooked. I mean, it ain't a 45, but it's like, it's off by, I mean, you can see, I mean, for a blacksmith, you'd be able to see that it's off by a mile. He's straight, ain't straight. So I said to him, I'm like, Jesus Christ, Dave, what the fuck? I mean, I was like, I was breaking his balls. And then I said to him, I'm like, you can't possibly be charging me full price for this. And he goes, oh, yeah, you're paying full price. I'm like, you're going to pay me full. You're going to charge me full price for this crooked ass hammer. And I said, you got it. And I gave him the money. And I said, because I am going to fucking be relentless to you, Dave Cardillo, you motherfucker. I am going to be relentless with this goddamn hammer. But with that said, you're going to be missed, and Dave is a great guy, and I'm really sad that he's gone.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
I had the good fortune of meeting him the first time, I think, actually at your shop, at one of your little hammer-ins.
That's right.
And I think at that event, he gifted me one of his bottle openers he had actually forged there at the thing. It was like the little skull bottle opener, and so I still have that, and I feel thankful to have a piece of his work.
Yeah.
And that's the sentimentality, right? He put a piece of himself into that, creating that thing, right? I think that's the beauty of the handmade things, right?
It's the amazing part is he progressed so much. Like he really invested his time and his energy, and he was eager to learn.
It was beautiful.
And he was
it's
a good
so
guy.
Clean. Yeah.
He spent a lot of time with a lot of great teachers. Like, he didn't noodle around on the internet.
Yeah.
He took classes, and he was very invested in CMA and very invested with other guys. And, he looked up to guys like you and other knife makers and, like, Peter Brasmanix and all these guys. And, he died too young. He died too young.
I will say I was always thankful to him when we would talk about pineapple on pizza. He was always in my corner. He would message
Jesus
me after we
Christ.
Mentioned it on the podcast, and
I
he
forgot.
Would and I would always, when I would see some sort of pineapple pizza, I would send it to him. And
I forgot about that.
Yeah, he was all about the pineapple on pizza.
He, he used to send me pineapples all the time. I think that was one of the things. He would send me pineapple emojis, and he needs anytime I posted, he needs pineapple. And he actually, the only time I ever had pineapple, I was at CMA with Pat, and they ordered like a pineapple bacon pizza, and I tasted it. I said, I got to know what this tastes like. And I ate it, and I was just like, this sucks, you know? And then he's like, no, you liked it. You liked it. Don't fucking lie. And then from then on, he's like, I saw you eat pineapple pizza. You loved it every second of it. But Damascus Dave was the man. And I know that if you look back into the early episodes, he was very involved in the questions.
For
and,
sure.
You know, I think he really, you know, he loved this podcast.
Yeah, he's very active with the show. Yeah,
I do. So. I have a question for you, Jeff.
Go ahead.
I don't know. Nobody ever told me how he got the nickname Damascus Dave. I remember meeting him at your place, and somebody, you or I don't know.
I think that, you know, here's the funny thing is he was, you know, here's the funny thing about blacksmiths.
Yeah.
None of us give a shit about, most of us don't give a shit about Damascus. Right. So, like, that was the crazy thing is, like, I know so many guys who are straight blacksmiths. Like, they don't really, they're not really much interested in it. You know, they want to know how the metal moves, not necessarily what's inside. So, like, I mean, no disrespect. But I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, you talk to a lot of these straight blacksmiths. They don't give a shit.
Yeah.
And he was so interested in learning everything. Like, my years at Center for Metal Arts, like, I was there for a long time. We never even heard the word Damascus. And we had teachers coming through. We had all this. We didn't even hear any of it. I didn't hear any of it, until I started making knives. I didn't know anything about it. So he was really interested in learning everything, and part of that was the Damascus. And I think that was like a, I think that they called him Damascus Dave because he wouldn't shut up about how to make Damascus. And I think that just stuck. And when I heard that they called him Damascus Dave, we just kept it going. And then I know that Cliff and John and we all called him Damascus Dave.
Yeah.
So I think Pat probably coined him Pat Damascus Dave once, or I don't know how it came up, but he was interested in learning a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
you know, his shit was good, and you know, it's funny. I like to tell these funny stories. Oh, and the last thing is he used to send us terrible stories, terrible jokes on the early days of Knife Talk, I was at a hammering with him at John's place, and. Sometimes, you know, he wouldn't say anything. Sometimes he would be very quiet. And then one time he told me and Jesse this story. And I don't remember the story, but it was a fucking crazy story with bikers and cops and drug dealers. Oh, and
I heard
and
that
I don't remember exactly what it was. And I was like, this is the most. And I turned to him and I'm like, this is the fucking redemption of you. You've got to write this all down. Mm-hmm. And you've got to let me read it on Full Blast. And there's an episode in the first year of Full Blast podcast. It's called The Redemption of Dave. And I have I've wanted to listen back to it, and I haven't had the chance. And I read, he wrote me a fucking 10-page article on this insane story with cops and drug dealers and gangs and that happened to him as a youth. So if you go back to the Redemption of Dave, it's his crazy story. And just to let you know, Dave didn't need any redemption. He's the fucking man, and wherever he is, I hope he's, you know, I hope he's well.
Yeah, thoughts with his family and friends. Yeah. Okay, well, that's a show. Thank you all for listening. We shall be back again next Monday. Bye for now.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.